Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
This is 45 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. John Copenhaver. He's in the room. What are you doing?
Hey, Al, I am sitting here chatting with you.
So now we've got a writer, and he's got a book out, The Busy Body, and it's a witty literary mystery with a stunning twist. So, Camper Donovan, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get into the writing world? Why would a sane person decide to write?
I got into the writing world pretty late, and I sort of had two different avenues into writing where I got really close to it before completely getting my feet wet, I guess. I was dipping multiple toes into the writing water. So first, I became a manager for screenwriters out of law school. I realized when I went to law school that I did not want to be a lawyer and I wanted to do something more creative. So I started managing screenwriters, and I live in Los Angeles. So I've been here now for many, many, many years. And that was my first career path out here. And then I realized that that was not even quite creatively engaging enough for me. And at that point, I started writing on the side. And the first book that I wrote was not a mystery. I'm not even sure what the genre is. Sometimes it's called adult contemporary, which makes it sound like music. Or sometimes it's called women's fiction, which I always think is redundant since most readers are women anyway. But it's a contemporary love story, I guess you could say, that has some suspense elements to it. But it wasn't until I started doing a podcast that's all about Agatha Christie, it's called All About Agatha, that I realized what an avid mystery fan I am, how passionate I am about mysteries. So that was my second sort of dipping my toe in something more specific to what I really wanted to write, which was mysteries. And The Busy Body is very much a mystery. It's a classic puzzle mystery, what some people would call a whodunit. It has lots of homages to Agatha Christie and her ilk built into it. And it's the first of three, actually. So I'm very much I'm in the middle of this mystery series and really loving it. So that is a very long-winded answer to how I came to this mystery series.
Well, there you go. How is it that you decide to actually write and publish and put your material out there? Like, usually there's something that spurs someone, like some event or something that happens that gives you, let's say, the courage, let's say the ability to kind of go, yeah, I'm gonna do this.
I've been a lifelong reader. I did not think that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up. That was never my goal. It really happened gradually. There was no cataclysmic event where I felt, oh my gosh, the the sort of thunderbolt has sounded, and now I know this is what I was meant to do and born to do. I think I really came to it gradually, bit by bit. Maybe, you know, being a manager and seeing the work of some of my clients, my screenwriters, you know, make it onto the big screen and how exciting that was for them. Probably thought to myself, oh, I'd like a little bit of that. But writing books is such a different process from getting movies made. And perhaps that was also part of the draw. I think once you've worked in an industry and seen it from all sides, you've seen how the sausage gets made. I think it can be hard sometimes to just forget all that or to do the forgetting you need to do to creatively engage as someone within that industry. So it was much easier for me, I think, to step outside of Hollywood and to try my hand at writing books, having been in Hollywood for a number of years at that point.
Right. You probably like it much better anyway.
I do. I mean, it's a simpler process, not necessarily internally, not for me, but in terms of the amount of people who have to be involved in taking whatever I've done and bringing it to an end point, to the point at which the book gets published. It's, you know, 100 times simpler than what has to happen for a movie or a TV show to go out on the air, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to sleep with near as many people for a book as you do to get a movie done. I'll tell you. I can't get up for weeks after a movie. But I noticed in this, like, so this is a dream, you say a dream assignment for former Senator Dorothy Gibson, and you talk about President of the United States. You're kind of, this is kind of a political situation. Is there a reason why your characters are in that, in the job that they're in?
Yeah, so I mentioned that I started this podcast about Agatha Christie. That was all the way back in September of 2016. And I actually started, the podcast was a joint endeavor with a really good friend of mine named Catherine Brobeck. Catherine and I actually interviewed John for the podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One of our best interview episodes, truly. I'm not just saying that because you can hear me right now.
So you haven't had very many.
Or maybe we just had really bad interview episodes. just to bring the hilarity down, Catherine actually passed away at the end of 2021. Oh. And I now do the podcast solo. But I always have to bring up Catherine because she's so important. The podcast never would have started without her. So there's that. But also, I think it was only with her sort of delighting in Christie and mystery overall that I tapped into what eventually, you know, allowed me to write this mystery, this politically driven mystery. And it actually really all started from right when the podcast originated. So September 2016, that was just a couple of months out from November 2016, which was the Hillary Clinton-Donald Trump face-off of an election. And right after that election happened, there was that weird period of time where Hillary Clinton had kind of holed up in her house and was like taking selfies in the woods, or other people were finding her in the woods behind her house and taking pictures of her. And it was so weird. And, you know, it was a very much a moment of like the country going through a bunch of stuff. This person who had just been through this experience, like what exactly was that like? And it never left me as the perfect backdrop for a murder mystery. And my former senator character, who's the detective, she's the amateur detective of the book, Dorothy Gibson, is based in part on Hillary Clinton. She's actually not only Hillary Clinton. She's also very much Margaret Chase Smith, who is a 20th century longtime senator and U.S. House of Representatives politician from Maine as well, and is someone I admire very much. Because I think that political moment was just seared in my brain, as it was for many people, that was sort of the seed that I started with when I was writing The Busybody. And, you know, potentially to its detriment overseas, because I think people get very nervous if you have a book steeped in American politics as to how that's going to be, you know, appreciated, you know, not in the U.S., but the book is in the U.K. and in Australia and New Zealand right now, and it seems to be doing okay. So fingers crossed that it can translate. But, yeah, that's why I chose a political setting.
Yeah, I think it does okay in Europe and other countries, as long as it's not so, you know, direct. If you got into much more detail than it needed to be, do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, you know, then it, you know, gets to. How do you relate to your character then, like your main character, you know, being a woman and being someone that's representative of Hillary Clinton, for instance, or someone that's big like that? How can you write that sort of character? How do you get into the mindset?
Sure. Well, and it's not only Dorothy Gibson, but the, you know, I chose to have a very traditional duo. So there's a detective sidekick duo who are the amateur team. And that's, you know, very Agatha Christie, Hastings, Poirot, Watson, Holmes, in the Sherlock Holmes mold. And it's my my sidekick character who is the first person narrator of the book. And she is also a woman. She's actually unnamed, so there's no name that I can give you for her. A la the unnamed narrator in Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, she never told me her name, so I just had to write around that because she's a very enigmatic and withholding character. But so it was not just Dorothy, but these two women who I sort of chose. And I can't really tell you why I did. I just always knew that I wanted. I wanted them as characters, or they're the ones that came to me as sort of the protagonists of this story. I was fascinated, I guess, on an intellectual level as to what the aftermath of that election would feel like to someone who was in Hillary Clinton's position. And I think a lot of the skills that someone in her position would have, the ways in which they can be deployed in an amateur murder investigation, were very interesting to me. and I think I made a lot of use of that in the mystery. My sidekick character who's narrating the story, so she is a ghostwriter who specializes in celebrity memoir. And she's writing the celebrity memoir of Dorothy Gibson, who I think believably in, you know, the aftermath of this election, she retreats to her house and she has all the time in the world that she didn't have immediately before this period. So she chooses to make good use of that time and work on her memoir that she's always been meaning to write. And there's a lot of, not a lot, but I think some ruminating on writing. And I'm a person who sits around and thinks a lot about writing and that process. So that spoke to me as well, even though I'm not a ghostwriter and I don't know all that much more than I think the next person about celebrity memoir, although I'm a big fan of them, or at least interested in them. And there have been a lot of high-profile ones, I think, in the last couple of years in particular. So I don't think I can give you a more satisfying answer to why, though, than that. It just felt right.
Then what is your relationship with your characters? Like, do you hear them, see them, watch them like a movie? How is it you kind of relate?
I think I definitely see them. It's funny. Someone recently asked me at an event that I did, oh, well, who would you cast in, like, the movie for, you know, of this book if it were going to be made into a movie? And having worked for a decade in Hollywood, you would think that I'd have an easy answer for that. And, of course, I'd be steeped in who would be doing the film version of this. But I find that I get to know the characters so well that I never think of actors when I think of the characters. I just think of them. Like, I just think of who they are and what they look like. And what they look like is a unique individual, just like any individual that you would see. So I never picture an actor because the actor would be the actor. So I guess that kind of gets at the intimacy that I feel with these characters. They don't speak to me. It's not like I have hallucinations of sitting down and, you know, having a meal or a conversation with them, but I do feel like I know them intimately.
Kepper, I am a huge fan, you know this already, of All About Agatha, and I've been listening for years, which is why I begged to be interviewed. It was such a wonderful interview. And I was thinking about, now you're
just... I don't think you begged to be interviewed. That's not my memory. But we also loved your book, loved your books as well. So that admiration.
I just wanted to chat. You know that thing where you're like kind of having one of those parasocial relationships, hanging out with, you know, Kemper and Catherine, listening to tear apart Agatha Christie with love. Then I heard that you were publishing a novel and a mystery novel. I was like, wow, what training. Because, you know, to go through all these plots and think analytically about literally every Agatha Christie novel must have been great training. So You know, now you're sitting down to write this thing. How did it help you? And did it ever intimidate you to have all that knowledge?
Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, I think it was both helpful and harmful. Helpful because it did steep me in, I mean, no one was better, I think, at those tricks or tropes or whatever you want to call them than Christy. She didn't really probably invent any of them, but she certainly popularized a lot of them and I think executed them, the best or as one of the best, around, you know, throughout the last 100 years. So I think studying Christy's structure, the way that she, you know, was able to obfuscate and then solve or reveal these puzzle solutions, I think that's helpful for a mystery writer. But then it becomes harmful because it is intimidating. And there's also, I think, the risk that you take of imitating, of then just trying to imitate another writer. And that's never good. I think you never want to imitate when it comes to voice or style or any of those aspects that are personal. And I don't even think I could do that if I tried, quite honestly, but the risk is that you will try and then it'll be really bad. So what I really tried to do was to separate out those structural elements from all the other aspects of writing a mystery. Not because they aren't important. I mean, the structure is uniquely important, I think, in a mystery. So for that, I really do owe a lot to all of the analytical work that Catherine and I did on the podcast. And I also wanted to sort of insert very Christie-ish tricks into the book that I knew would be recognized by readers of the podcast. I mean, there are a couple of tricks in particular that Catherine and I would harp on again and again, lovingly. We'd lovingly critique how many times Christy would do certain things. And I made a point to use those tricks in my book, knowing that podcast listeners would read it and smile to themselves and be like, oh, I see what you're doing there, Kemper. But it's not necessary to be in on that little meta joke at all if you haven't listened to the podcast. So that was a way of like having my cake and eating it too as a podcast host and a mystery author. And then just trying to separate that out and write a book that really doesn't in any way feel like an Agatha Christie novel, because I'm not Agatha Christie, and she more so than I think so many other people has a writing style that is of its own kind. I mean, she did not write conventionally, and I think her economy and sort of the efficiency of her prose is something that, like, if you try to do that and it doesn't come naturally to you, I think it could be disastrous. So I just almost went in completely the other direction with style and did what felt natural to me, even though some of the underpinnings of the mystery definitely I owe to Christy, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah, I think it's sort of, I mean, a blending of your voice and a lot of the tropes and tricks and, you know, cleverness that she brings to the genre, or defined for the genre, or perfected, however you want to put it,
right,
you know.
Right.
I know this probably is a hard question to ask or answer, but I'm going to ask it. Were there particular mysteries of hers that you found speaking to you for this, and were they necessarily your favorites?
There weren't, actually, and I'm not just avoiding answering your question for fear of spoilers.
Okay.
I probably would, because, you know, you'd have to be really familiar with the mystery even to be spoiled. But and at that point, you should just read my mystery, too, if you're that much of a fan. But no, there weren't. I mean, because a lot of the Christie-ish things that I did were, I think, again, tricks that were spread over a lot of different stories of hers, a lot of the short stories even. There are some motifs, some sort of Christie-ish motifs that tended to crop up in the early Poirot short stories that are narrated by Hastings that I made, I think, a lot of use of. But to the extent that I think some of the tricks do appear in some later Christie novels, especially, which generally aren't my favorites, although there are some of her later novels that I really do cherish. But I tended not to be inspired by, like, what we call the quote-unquote crown jewel Christies, right? You know, like Murder on the Orient Express, and Then There Were None, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, a murder is announced. I didn't take anything directly from those, and I was glad that I didn't, because then I think that might feel a little obvious. Like, those Christie Easter eggs really are Easter eggs that I think you're only going to get if you're a podcast listener and or a true Christie geek. That was my intention.
Cool. Yeah, I love it. It's a very meta Christie experience. Yeah. Well, another question. I'm a college professor. I also teach writing, and I talk to students a lot about genre writing. And, of course, I'm a fan. I have had lots of conversations with students, and they seem to be they understand what a thriller is. But when I actually talk to them about something like a mystery or whodunit, they seem a little more baffled by that. I don't mean like they don't know it sort of conceptually, but they're, I guess, don't really understand how the genre speaks to them. And I was wondering, because you've been steeped particularly in whodunits, you know, how would you go about explaining to them, like, what's the difference between a mystery or a thriller, or what should we love about mysteries?
Yeah, I mean, it's like the genre title of mystery means so many different things, right? Like I think there's a fuzziness to it that's both a good and a bad thing. I mean, one of the things I like now, having bought into, you know, being a mystery writer, is that I think it means you can actually write a lot of different stuff. It's not as constrictive, I think, as some of the other labels can be. But for that reason, I think sometimes there is some confusion as to, like, when someone says, oh, well, you know, this is a mystery, what that exactly means. I mean, the way I kind of tend to bifurcate things is that you have more linear writing, which is, you know, falls under the subheading of thrillers. And then you have this puzzle writing, you know, you have something that has a puzzle as its backbone, a solvable puzzle. And that's the puzzle mystery, or the whodunit, or the fair play mystery is what some people call it, which was very much popularized during the golden age of detective fiction, which is roughly between the two world wars, even though it's kind of on, you know, both the other sides of both wars, actually, and especially post-World War II. And people are still writing them now, especially in the UK, but even in the US. So, and the difference is that those puzzles are solvable, that you can actually read the mystery actively, and you can arrive... You're given the tools as a reader to arrive at the solution at the same time as, or potentially even before, the fictional detective, whatever the investigative presence is within the book. So you have the ability to arrive at the quote-unquote correct solution. And within that, I mean, there are a million ways to complicate that model, you know? But that's kind of, that's the puzzle model, or, you know, again, the whodunit umbrella. And then thrillers are kind of everything else, right? I mean, even though they're propulsive, even though they have a mystery, say, at their heart of, like, you know, what happened, who did what, it could even be who killed what, the way that they proceed is in more of a linear fashion, and there's no game being played with the reader. It's a story that is being told, you know, and you read it as you would a story in any other genre. And even though you might get the satisfaction at the end of you know, figuring out what's going on and that everything is revealed, you don't have that game aspect where you have the ability to read it actively. And the last thing I would just say is there, you know, as a major caveat, is that you don't have to read those puzzle mysteries actively. You don't have to actually try to solve them. And I actually don't myself. I'm very happy to read an Agatha Christie mystery or any other puzzle mystery and just have the solution told to me at the end and kind of marvel at the way that it works. I sort of like reading it passively and then thinking about it after the fact. As to, oh, right, so that was that clue that was there, and it was misleading because of this, you know, for this reason, and that's how she managed to layer it in there, and I never picked up on it. And I like seeing how the solution works without necessarily actively engaging in it myself. And I think some people feel there's almost like a sense of shame in passively reading a puzzle mystery. I think Edmund Wilson, the critic, you know, very famously, he couldn't believe that there were people who would read those mysteries passively. And he said, what's the point? Like, why would you ever read those mysteries without trying to figure it out? But I think it's absolutely fine. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. And don't you forget that. So how does something like this process change you when you go through your characters and put them through what you're going to and at the end of the book? How has it changed you?
how has it changed me as a writer? Or
I'm leaving it as open to you. How does it change you as a human? How does it change you as a writer? Like, do you feel like at the beginning of the process, you kind of have the idea, you start putting it together, the characters, and you're kind of thinking about Hillary Clinton and the election and then the terms after, mm-hmm. someone like her, going, like you're putting it all together. So in a way, you live through these characters for however long it takes you to write the book. Do you know what I mean? Like, you feel mm-hmm. what they're going mm-hmm. through. So at the end of it, yeah, does it change you in any way, maybe as a person or even as just as a writer or a podcast or anything? Does it, do you feel no difference?
I have to say, especially having spent as many years as I did reading mysteries closely and analyzing them as a reader, it is odd to now be constructing them myself. And to be sort of like putting the pieces together as, you know, as the kind of author who I'm used to just guessing as to what might be in her mind, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's Agatha Christie that I'm reading when I'm engaging in that readerly process. And it's really weird to be the one in her position now. You know, I mean, the thing about mysteries, too, is that mysteries, of course, are stories like any other story in any other genre. And I think that it's, of course it changes you. I mean, I think if you're doing it right, you're empathizing, right? Like, you're engaging in these not random acts of empathy, but very, very intentional and pointed acts of empathy, over the, you know, the period that you're writing the book. And I think that can't help changing you. If you really are doing that right and engaging in the process. I think it was audacious of me to choose, you know, two women as this investigative duo, but that always just felt right to me and like what I should do. And I think at some point every writer has to negotiate that process of writing across difference, and you know, unless your books are going to be super, super boring and just, you know, about one static identity, whatever you happen to think your identity is, which is probably not what someone else will perceive your identity as being, by the way. I kind of just went full bore with that and hoped that I was being interesting and authentic at writing, you know, in a woman's voice and writing this story from a female point of view. And I'm doing it again in books 2 and 3 because I have the same sidekick ghostwriter, narrator. She is the only presence who is going to be traveling from book to book. She's teaming up with different detectives in each new story. And I've actually already written the second one, and I'm very happy to still be with her and feeling mainly good feelings about her. So I guess for myself anyway, that shows that I'm doing something right.
Well, what if she doesn't want to be with you?
I should call too bad.
Well, there you have it. Who's the boss? Well, you know. So at the beginning of this book, like when you had the ideas, I guess you had some of the characters first, and then you decided how you were going to put them, like what kind of situation and develop the story and all that. But at the beginning there, when you kind of were putting it together and how it finished, did it end up where you thought it would be?
Mainly did. And absolutely, I started with characters for this. I really did start with those two characters and that situation, the aftermath of a very public election. And then I kind of built out from there. I did outline the mystery. Since it is a puzzle mystery, especially, I do not have the courage or maybe foolhardiness to just start writing a puzzle mystery without figuring out in a macro way how it's going to be solved and what all the different pieces are. I feel like I have to figure that out ahead of time. So none of those large pieces really changed, but a whole lot of, you know, the in-between stuff did. And I feel like the in-between stuff is...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
The meat and potatoes of writing, or what I love about writing, which is kind of, you know, character work and, you know, writing on a sentence level and style and figuring out your settings and who these people actually are and you know, the very specific ways in what that they're going to interact and how you're setting up a scene and what specifically happens during a scene. Even though you might know that X, Y, and Z has to happen, there's a million different ways to pull that off, you know? So these people do end up being different, I think, from how you initially conceived them. So, yeah, I mean, I think they, I learned a lot more about them as I was writing. I did not know who they were in the beginning, even though I probably thought I did, but I didn't.
Yeah, you learned it as you go. When you have someone evil in your book, or someone that does the murder or killing, how do you write that character?
Well, I think it depends, obviously, on the kind of story that you're telling, but I think it's really interesting to be able to convey why someone does a horrible thing and to empathize with that person as well. Or at least I think it helps make it more, the overall story more believable. And I think that's, you know, one of the most interesting things that a writer can do, because you're giving yourself the power to get inside you know, these people's heads to a certain extent. I mean, I have a first-person narrator, so I'm only inside my narrator's head, technically, but I'm obviously creating the world that she is perceiving, and, you know, I'm making up the dialogue that she's having or overhearing between other people. So I think so often in my own life, I'm baffled by the things that people do or say, and I feel like I don't understand them, but what I can do as a writer, even when people are doing horrible things, is to try to make sense of it and show why, and, you know, the reasons behind these awful things. So I approach those characters with the same sort of deep empathy that I try to give to everyone.
You know, one thing that's so interesting, I think, particularly for a proper puzzle mystery, is, you know, how you actually get to know the villain. You know, so often, because they have to be obscured, their real motivation has to be obscured, it is a challenge to figure out how to develop them as a character. And I've always thought, what a challenge for particularly a puzzle mystery writer to say, I'm going to make this character known, and not as the killer, but known what their psychology is, their point of view is early, and then somehow obscure from the reader that they they're the actual, you know, the person, the villain, the person who did it. So I don't know, what challenges did you face along those lines?
Yeah, it's really challenging, and I have to say that's one of the things that Agatha Christie generally does so well. There's so many different aspects of her writing that she does not get enough credit for, but that's absolutely such a tricky thing to do, where when you have a whodunit, you have to hide the ball a little bit, right, as to who done it. And that means that you often are, you know, a little limited in terms of conveying who this very central and like crucial character is. And there are certain books of hers where you do get that cliched effect of the mask being pulled off, and it's like, oh, whoa, this person is completely different from what they seemed like for 200 pages, and now that we're in the last 20 pages, I guess this is who they really are. And sometimes that can be okay, but sometimes that can be frustrating, and it can feel fake and not satisfying as a reader. And I think there are a lot of a lot of mysteries that suffer from that problem. Christie usually was able to figure that out just with deft characterization, where I think she would give hints, she would give clues, or the solving of the puzzle itself actually hinges on character, where it's like, oh, all these people thought a certain thing about this character, but it was actually flipped. You know, the person who they thought was weak was actually strong, or there was some aspect of their character that was being misperceived, and now they actually are seeing the light, and it makes sense as to why they, you know, the misperception existed, and then why they're able to see things the way that they really are once we're into the solution, as long as we can sort of go along on that journey and it's not something that's just imposed upon us by an amateur detective pointing a finger and being like, you, it is you. And then you just have that, you know, that kind of cheesy reveal moment. If it's something that can be sort of like tethered to the story and to who these people are, and what's happening to them, she's really good at doing that. And I thought a lot about that actually as I was writing The Busybody, because I have that kind of denouement moment where all the characters are gathered together, and then the culprit sort of explains and is different, you know, from how they're perceived earlier on in the story, but hopefully it you can sort of understand why and how it worked, and it has a believability to it. I think that's what you need to go for. It's obviously all heightened, but that's okay, as long as I think there is some believability attached to that reveal.
Yeah, I think that is really true. I really admire when you, mystery is where you do have all the elements of a character's personality, but it's just you haven't quite seen them in the right light.
Right.
That, you know, things need to be tilted a certain way. And I feel like they're particularly powerful if it feels, you know, very inevitable that they would be the killer, but you just didn't see it. I just got so angry at like Matlock or some of the more poorly written, you know, shows of that sort. They had churned out so many of them, but it could have been any of these three characters. It was like choose one. It didn't really matter. And I always felt like, well, that wasn't, you know, like it needed to be more holistic in some way.
Yeah, it has like a randomness to it that's not, that can be unsatisfying if it feels too just sort of like paint by numbers.
Right, exactly. It kind of has to feel like you just weren't quite looking at it the right way. It's much more fun to see that or to go through that than it just could have been, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. And anyway, but of course it takes a lot more skill to prepare the reader for that feeling. In your process, you mentioned outlining, and I know for my own like journey as a writer, I think it was probably because I was the product of MFA programs, but I was not outlining first. You just need to write into the characters, and then suddenly I'd realize, crap, I need to figure out what's going on and completely outline the thing. And my last book actually did start with an outline, which was such a nice feeling. Are there any dangers since, you were outlining? Is there any danger to an outline, or do you ever feel confined by an outline, or anything of that sort? Or do you feel mostly that, there's a sort of security in having one?
I think if you're too tied to it, I mean, my editor always says, because I do submit an outline before I start writing, before I go off to writing, just to make sure, like, are you cool with this? This is generally something that you want me to do. I mean, he always says, this is a blueprint, and if you end up having to, obviously within reason, and he never has defined what that is, but I kind of know what he means. Within reason, we realize that this is going to shift and change as you're writing it. And that's just know that that's fine. And I think so that's given me the best of both worlds, which is security without feeling, like confined by the outline. Like, oh, now I can't do anything outside of what I said. And, oh, no, I didn't realize when I first started. Because, of course, as you're in the act of writing the manuscript, I have so many moments where I'm just like, oh, my God, I can't believe that I thought this had to happen. Of course that can't happen. That's insane. And I have to go in this different direction, or I have to do 18 things first before I can get to there. So lots and lots of changes, but it really just is a framework. Like, it's really just, like, I think I said, an underpinning. Like, that's how I try to think of it, and I can really do pretty much what I want to do otherwise. I think you need to feel that freedom, and the danger is not giving yourself that freedom if you've outlined. And I think that's what scares a lot of people from doing outlines in the first place. And I totally understand that.
Have you had to reimagine a character in a way that you weren't really prepared to in your process? In other words, if your plan for a character started out one way, and you had to, because of things you're discovering along the way, and maybe this is even in the outlining phase, you really had to see them differently. Did that happen at all? And if so, why?
Absolutely. I think, the other thing, the other challenge with the murder mystery is that you usually have more than one murder that you're featuring in the course of the story. And, a traditional whodunit usually has 2 to 3, right? Catherine and I would always joke on the podcast about that late third murder in some Agatha Christie novels, where it would feel like she just sort of had to pad out the story a little bit, like, uh-oh, we're only at, page 170, got to add a third murder. But I've, the second book, which I've actually just written, actually does feature three murders. And that's not a spoiler, because I labeled each part of the book first murder, second murder, and third murder. And I changed who got murdered. I changed who got murdered and the order in which they got murdered as I was writing, because I was realizing that my initial conception wasn't working out. So, in that the structure really does, you have to work. Like, you definitely, like, to me, that's kind of the foremost concern. And then because you can always, alter character and character interactions based on who needs to do what for the working of your puzzle. You just need to make sure and that you're nimble about it and that you do it well, so it doesn't feel shoehorned. Because if you don't have time, I think that might be when it starts to feel shoehorned, if you're not then backing up the decisions you make with, good characterization, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, at that one, I had to change quite a bit, actually, as I was writing.
Do you like to write your characters with a sense of humor?
Yes. Yes, there's a lot of humor in these books, actually, and since it has a first person narrator, she's a little quippy, and I definitely imbued her voice with lightness. It's one of my favorite things, especially in a murder mystery, to have moments of lightness, because I think there's obvious moments of darkness in any murder mysteries, but unless you're doing it in a really satirical way, because people are dying, and you have to depict that, and you also have to depict the way that the people around those people are grieving about it or feeling about it. So it was very important to me, actually, to inject a lot of humor into the story, and that's something I plan to do for all of them.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of like a comedian. You have to have a good sense of timing of where you put it as well.
Yes, and you can't do it too much either. One of the my agent actually reads before I send the manuscript into my editor, and it's becoming a pattern that she instructs me to excise as many of my sort of jokey parenthetical asides that I have my narrator make as possible. Like, she tells me which ones should definitely go and then which ones she thinks should go, because a little of that goes a long way. So I think you can easily overdo the jokes and the quips, and it can become annoying. So I rely on other people to rein me in, I guess, when it comes to that.
Bring the whip.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so what do you hope people get out of the book? When you wrote this book, did you have kind of a subtext, or is it just all about entertainment?
I think, entertainment and diversion is hugely important. So I love when I hear from people that they enjoyed reading the book and they had a few hours away from whatever they were dealing with. And I think that's sort of my primary motivation. I think that's most writers' primary motivation, maybe not, but so that's hugely important. But I think there are themes in the story, and given, the moment in which it's anchored, because the entire story basically takes place between this presidential election and the inauguration of the person who won. So it's within this frozen kind of period where people, I think, are grappling with what is going to happen and the direction that the country is going to take. There's a lot, I think, that I'm hopefully exploring in a way that would make people reflect on that moment in our country and where we are now, many years ahead of that. Not in a didactic way or like a taxing way, but hopefully just in a way that would help them reflect on it, as they wouldn't do otherwise without reading the book. I think there is often, that's like a secondary kind of thematic preoccupation that underlies the entire mystery.
Okay, and now you're working on, you said you got book two, is that what you're working on now, or you got it just about done?
Book two is sort of in revision. It's sort of in the middle of the revision stage, and I'm outlining book three right now.
Busy man. How long does it take you to do a book, roughly?
It took me, it ended up taking me about 5 months to do book two, which was a little tight for me. I had a period of panic where I thought I wasn't going to finish it on time. So I'm going to start book three a little earlier so that I don't have to feel like I'm running up against my deadline as hard as I did. It ended up being fine, but I had, in the middle of the process where I still had a lot of the book to write, and I was like, oh no, am I going to turn around and the deadline is 2 weeks away and I still have a really big chunk of this book to write? And I was able to get myself out of that hole, but I'd love to not feel like I'm falling into the hole in the first place. So I'm thinking more like 6 or 7 months might be ideal. I'm still figuring that out though.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you ever can really figure it
out. Yeah, that's true. And every book is different, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you just don't know how it's going to end and what kind of holes you get into in your mind, as you're writing.
Yes.
What kind of issues you face. So, and Agatha Christie, I guess she's a writer. I should look her up.
She
writes mysteries.
She writes mysteries, yeah, okay. You know.
Is she any good?
She's she's pretty good.
She's okay.
I'll say she's okay. Pretty good.
three out of five star or something like that.
Were you at all a Christie fan when you were, I mean, as an author yourself? I'm just curious.
No. I don't dislike her. I'm not like a, you know, a hater or dislike her or anything like that. How's that?
I always laugh because kids these days have YA, and I had Agatha Christie. I don't know, maybe I was just an odd kid, but there is just something about Agatha Christie and sort of high school, middle school even, or at least, I don't know if that's true today. I would not necessarily make that statement for students today, but I think, you know, when I was growing up, I think a lot of us were reading them, and then Stephen King.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, I was definitely, I say this, she's kind of like a gateway drug for a lot of people who like read her when they were around like 9 or 10. And then, you know, you use that almost like as a bridge to adult reading. She hated that when people would say that she was like juvenile fiction, though. She was like, children should not be reading me. I'm for adults. But it's just true. Like there are a lot of kids who just like devoured her around that time. And I think if that happens, you just have a special place in your heart for whoever that author is or whatever those stories are. They stick with you in a way that, you know, the authors who come later just can't. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. And each generation has their own innocence to a sense. You know what I mean? Like someone growing up in the 40s and 50s, there was a different sense of values and innocence that they had compared to someone now. You know,
absolutely.
It's a totally different world. So you don't know. What about the, you know, with the publishers changing some of her writings and stuff or updating it to make it more sensitive to modern generations? How do you feel about stuff like that?
Yeah, I've talked a little bit about this. I mean, I think that it's a complicated issue. You know, I think there's one aspect of it where I don't think we have all the information and it frustrates me that we don't. But this came about, you know, I don't know, about a year ago or maybe 6 months ago, because people noticed that some of the Kindle versions of her books were either excising in particular, you know, language that would be perceived as racist or anti-Semitic from her books. What I'm not clear on is whether or not the original texts will always be available should you want to look at the original texts. If that's the case, if we always have, you know, a way to access the original words that she wrote, but there's, you know, another version that her publisher is putting out, you know, as an option, which is, you know, what we have with a couple of other of these sorts of big name literary estates. If that's the case, I have less of an issue with that. I mean, I'm someone who obviously always wants to be able to read the unvarnished Agatha Christie, even just from a scholarly perspective. But I think it's important that you know, those original words be available. But the other thing complicating it is, you know, from the very beginning, for example, I mentioned And Then There Were None, which is one of the Christie crown jewels. As many people know, that book was first published in the UK under a very different title that many people find offensive. I'm not going to say what the title was, Ten Little, and, you know, the N-word. Yeah. I'm not going to say the word. And from the beginning, in 1939, in Agatha Christie's own lifetime, that was changed to And Then There Were None for the U.S. market. And not only the title, but the word appears many, 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 many times in the book. So those sorts of changes were already being made in Agatha Christie's time. And I think people like to get all up in arms and pretend like these issues are only happening now and this is something that, you know, is happening for the first time. But if you're okay with that, if you're okay with that book being turned into And Then There Were None with all of those words being changed within the text itself, well, then that means that it's more a matter of degree. And then you just have to figure out where, you know, where is the dividing line? And I think that's a little bit more of a nuanced question. And some people like to pretend that, no, this is something that's never happened, and now we live in a different age of censorship or something. I can't believe this is happening. I don't think that's necessarily true. So I'm not as, you know, I think horrified or reactive to it as some might be. And I just think it's a bit more of a complex question.
Yeah, yeah, it goes much deeper. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I think they should always have the original available, because she was who she was and she wrote what she did, and that's kind of all part of it. I don't like to see it changed myself.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, it's out of my hands. It's all up to John.
Well, you know, I mean, my biggest issue is that, you know, if you do start changing the texts, it will start erasing the past. And I think, you know, unwittingly, maybe there is a real problem with, you know, basically making things, I guess, more appealing to contemporary ears, more respectful, can make you also forget what the past was. So I'm fine if they change the text, but I would love a little context for that change, like a note saying, we've changed the words, here's what they were. If you want the original text, you know, something that sort of lets people know, you know, this is not, history was what it was. need to remember that she had, you know, she was biased in all sorts of ways in her time, and we can't really pretend that she wasn't.
No, and I think it's important to understand that that's what made her who she was. Everything about
her choice of
what she did for a living, of who she married, where she lived, and how she was, all of that makes up the writer. So I don't, you know.
No,
I mean, John's getting ready because he's worried about what they're going to do with his books in 10 years.
Well, who knows what any of us are may have biases now that are like, what, you know, I would hope that I would change with the times and, you know, and be aware that I was making a mistake. But certainly there are things that any of us are probably not wholly aware of that, you know, maybe there's certainly things that we are aware of, but I think it's just, it's complex. You never know.
I also think it's the ultimate compliment. It's like you were just saying, to be around for long enough that people can get offended at some future date about the stuff that you wrote. I mean, we should all be so lucky to have written something in 2024 that's going to be around in, you know, 2124, which is what's happening with Agatha Christie. I mean, she wrote her first book in 1920. It's now over 100 years, of course. And I always try to remind people of this. Yes, a lot of those opinions, many of which are in the mouths of characters, by the way. It's not like she's just speaking as an author. So often it's the work of characterization that she's doing when she's putting what seems to be offensive into the mouths of characters. But she's nowhere near as bad, as quote unquote bad, as a lot of her contemporaries. I mean, you start reading some of the more obscure authors of the Golden Age, and oh boy, it's much worse than that. So the fact that her books are as readable as they are, even in their original language, I think also speaks well for her. It's just, yeah, I feel very conflicted about it, and I think that feeling conflicted about it and acknowledging that it's complex and it probably doesn't have like a simple answer is the way to go, especially when I hear from people through the podcast who say, well, some of those changes help me, you know, read these books and enjoy these books and engage with them in the way that she clearly meant for them to be engaged in, especially given that so many marginalized people do gravitate toward puzzle mysteries. And Catherine and I talked about that a lot on the podcast, too. I mean, she was a woman and I'm a gay man. And there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of people who love that kind of active role that the puzzle mystery gives to you, that sense of agency. And there's a lot that's been written about that, that it's, you know, one reason that the puzzle mystery and sort of the whodunit was from the very beginning very attractive to a lot of female readers and other marginalized readers. And like, that's one of my favorite things about Agatha Christie and those books. So in a certain way, is it serving that, you know, to make some of these changes in a smaller way? I don't know. I'm just honestly not sure, but it's, I think, something people will continue to grapple with.
Well, listen, how do you like to be found? I mean, do you have social media? Do you have a website? Do you like readers to come interact with you some places, like Grindr? Like what? where do you like to have interaction from readers?
I have a website that's KemperDonovan.com, And there's even a little, like, you can get in touch with me thing there. So you could send me a message through my website or through the podcast. I'm on Twitter, which I'm still just calling Twitter, at All About the Dame. And then on Instagram at All About Agatha. And I have a Facebook page, even though Facebook just befuddles me and I have no idea what I'm doing on there, which is called Kemper Donovan Books. So you could try to reach me there if you dare. And and of course the podcast itself is called All About Agatha, and that is accessible. It's free to download wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want hundreds and hundreds of hours of me droning on about Agatha Christie, often with my friend Catherine.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you dress up like Agatha Christie?
We draw the line at cosplay. That we don't do that. Gotta draw, that's where I draw the line. I don't put on a little fake mustache. Yes. I put on a Belgian accent as Monsieur Poirot.
Now I was looking forward to that. Now what am I going to do? Well, we appreciate you being on the show. Time is flying, and we're out of time. So the book is called The Busy Body, and it's a witty, literary mystery with a stunning twist. And the guest is the author, Kemper Donovan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. This is really, really fun. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, Kemper.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or show, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or show, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.